From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today is the day in Florida. Many businesses reopening, although restaurants and retail stores will only be allowed to have 25% capacity. And the reopening does not apply to Florida's most populous counties, Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate is back in session today, even as Washington, D.C. remains under stay-at-home orders and the House of Representatives remains shuttered. The Supreme Court has started back up, too, and for the first time ever, it is hearing oral arguments over the phone. We're joined now by NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, let's start with the Senate. The Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called the Senate back into session. Democrats are not happy about it, but with the House still out, what does the Senate plan to do?
The Senate is going to do the things that it can do by itself, like judicial nominations or executive branch nominations. Those are things that Mitch McConnell has made his number one priority, and that's going to continue. They don't need the House for that.
And what about the House? Has Speaker Pelosi given any indication of when they might return?
Well, that's really interesting. She has said they might return next week. She says that she's going to follow the recommendations of the Capitol attending physician, Brian Monahan, who has said, interestingly enough, that he doesn't have enough COVID tests for even 100 senators. You know, the White House offered Congress some tests after he issued that statement. And in a rare show of unity, Nancy Pelosi and the majority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, wrote a joint statement saying, no, thank you. We would rather save the tests for people who really need them. The president didn't like that. He tweeted, maybe you need a new doctor over there. But the different approach to opening between the House and the Senate really mirrors the red-blue divide that we're seeing all over the country about how fast and how safely the states can open up. And the Republicans in the House have been pushing to open. They've issued some recommendations they think could make it safe, more plexiglass barriers, larger hearing rooms. Some lawmakers could participate in hearings from home. So the House is still a work in progress, but it sounds like they'll open maybe next week.
Well, one of the things that people are going to be looking for from Congress potentially is more economic relief, maybe another package. But President Trump now says he would only sign another bill if it includes a payroll tax cut. How does that demand go over with lawmakers?
Well, not all Republicans are on board with that, and not all Democrats are. It's interesting. The president has said nothing's going to move forward without a payroll tax cut. Mitch McConnell said nothing's going to move forward unless corporations are protected from lawsuits around the pandemic. For instance, meatpacking workers who say they've been forced to work in unsafe conditions without protective equipment. And McConnell has also said he doesn't want to provide aid to the states. States should consider declaring bankruptcy if it comes to that. So there are a lot of red lines that are being laid down by Republicans. Democrats want aid to the states. The one area where you could potentially see some compromises on infrastructure, the president says he wants a big infrastructure investment. Democrats have always wanted that. But the bottom line is, we're a very long way away from the next package of economic aid.
President Trump also responded to news that he received two intelligence briefings on the coronavirus in January. He downplayed their significance on Twitter yesterday, saying they only spoke of the virus, he's talking about his advisors, in a very non-threatening or matter-of-fact manner. How does this play into the president's defense of his early pandemic response?
The president is determined to convince voters that he acted swiftly, despite a lot of evidence that he didn't. And he said yesterday in this Fox virtual town hall that the intelligence community is going to be coming out with a statement today saying that they didn't warn him. Now that he's put his own people in charge of the intelligence community, maybe that will happen. But what the president is determined to do is to not be seen as being responsible for a slow and halting response to the virus. He said famously it's not his responsibility. And his political advisors know that his reelection, at least right now, depends on how voters judge his leadership in that crisis. So he has been running ads. He says at every opportunity that he acted swiftly and decisively. He focuses a lot on cutting off travel from China, at least for non-U.S. citizens, which he did back in the winter, to say that was a early response. But this is very important. You know, he's going to be judged by how he dealt with this crisis. So it's important that he not be seen as being warned and ignoring those warnings.
Well, and he's going to apparently start traveling again next week. Let's listen here to Vice President Mike Pence at the Fox News town hall yesterday, apologizing for not wearing a mask at the Mayo Clinic last week.
I didn't think it was necessary, but I should have worn the mask at the Mayo Clinic. And I wore it when I visited the ventilator plant in Indiana.
So that brings me to this question, Mara. If the president's going to travel and the vice president says he should have worn the mask, is the president, just briefly, going to wear a mask when he travels?
First of all, I don't know. Second of all, it's hard to imagine the president wearing a mask. It's just that if he did, that would be an extraordinary moment. But I also have to say, Mike Pence, having a very human response to that question, saying I should have worn a mask, was also an amazing moment in that town hall because he really did set himself apart from the president.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Europe now, where several countries are easing lockdown restrictions. Today, Italy, the first country in the world to implement a nationwide lockdown, is relaxing some of its restrictions for the first time in more than 2 months. And as you probably know, Italy has been one of the hardest hit countries in this coronavirus pandemic. The death toll is nearly 29,000, a country, of course, much smaller than the U.S. NPR's Silvia Pagioli has been in that lockdown. She joins us from Rome. Silvia, so just outline for us, what will people be doing now that some of these restrictions are lifted?
Well, one thing is what they can do and what they are doing. Today was the first day, and my sense is that people are really taking it very slowly, very cautiously. I did not see many, many people out in the street, more than before. There was some traffic, but by pre-pandemic Roman standards, it felt like a quiet August when everybody goes away on vacation. There were some joggers, more people on the streets. Everyone is wearing face masks. But, you know, very few things can open. It's only manufacturing, construction sites, retail shops, except for bookstores and grocery stores, are not yet allowed to open. That's to avoid crowding. And, for instance, today I saw my bike shop is open, but it's only for repairs, not for sales.
Well, and you mentioned what sounds like this fear, and we heard about this in China as well. People emotionally and maybe psychologically affected by what they went through, not leaping out into the streets in joy. You know, it's interesting. Here in the United States, we have a lot of headlines now about how masks and social distancing have become kind of a political statement. People who don't like to be told by the government what to do, rejecting them. How is that playing out there in Italy?
Well, I've seen that this coronavirus pandemic has had an amazing effect in reversing national stereotypes. Italians are the first to admit that they are the least law-abiding people on the face of the earth. And nobody has been more observant, I think, of the rules. This has been a very, very tough lockdown, one of the most restrictive, certainly in Europe. And Italians have been extraordinarily obedient. And as I said, everybody I saw outside was wearing a face mask. It's required inside indoor public places, but it has not necessarily been required as you walk down the street, but they were all wearing them. And yeah, there's a lot of anxiety about going out. One person I talked to said, you know, at first the lockdown was an imposition, then it became a kind of cocoon, very protective, and now we're all a little bit afraid to venture out into the world, this new world that nobody really knows what the new rules are going to be like.
Well, but this lifting of restrictions, you know, it's supposed to come here in the States with a declining infection rate. That's not happening in many places here in the state. The opening's happening anyway. But what's going on there in Italy? Has the curve been flattened? Remind us.
Oh, yes, definitely. There's been a decline, and it's had a very slow decline. But in the last few weeks, it's been declining, and that's why we had the reopening. The government, though, has made it very clear that if the infections rise again, lockdowns will resume, if not nationwide, at least in the areas where there are the infections. There's been a lot of pressure on the government from business associations to open up everything faster to try to offset the economic impact of the pandemic, which is, you know, going to be probably very devastating. But generally, public opinion, as I said, has been on the side of the government.
Well, and I was going to say, we mentioned the government. How is the government being seen by the people?
Well, it's doing very well, and especially Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte, who, frankly, was more or less a nobody until before the pandemic started. He had no political experience when he was tapped as a sort of compromise candidate to lead the coalition government. But he's been a little bit awkward at times, but he has grown tremendously in stature. Now, he's obviously attacked by the right-wing populist opposition for his cautious approach, but his popularity, it dropped a little bit over the last month, but he still has a 64% popularity rating. You know, the biggest test is going to be ahead, dealing with the economic crisis. Already the lockdown has inflated the ranks of the poor. There's been a huge increase in people seeking charity. You know, it's going to be tougher ahead than it's even been up to now.
But interesting, Italians are not blaming their government for that lockdown. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli in Italy, lifting some lockdown restrictions today for the first time in more than 2 months. Sylvia, just what's the first thing you want to do?
Well, I really, really want to go to the beach, even though it's a little early. But that's going to be a while because we still have restrictions on travel outside of your region. And where I want to go is in Tuscany. And I think it's going to be probably another month or so before I can do that.
You have to join the rest of us dreaming. Sylvia, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
One of the many things you may have missed lately amid all the coronavirus news, the 2020 Pritzker Architecture Prize was awarded to the co-founders of the Irish design firm Grafton Architects. That would be Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara. I spoke with them in March, shortly after they won the prize, which is sometimes referred to as the Nobel for Architecture. And I asked them how being based in Ireland informs their design.
It's a wonderful thing to come from this country. Both Shelley and I are products of the Irish education system, and we've had wonderful opportunities here to be architects, and we were building here for many years before we won an international competition for Bocconi University in Italy.
It's probably not terribly well known, but the culture of architecture that has grown in Ireland over the last 10 years, let's say 15 years, has been gradually getting stronger. And in many ways, the fact that we were invited to curate the Venice Biennale in 2018 was a recognition of this, that people are starting to realize that perhaps something interesting is happening in Ireland.
And Jeremy, to add to that, it's also that when you live on an island, what is fantastic is that you both have indigenous influences, but also you're ready to receive indigenous from other places. Mm-hmm. So you also have a perspective that's both very anchored in place, but also very open to the influences at a global level.
A lot of your work features big open spaces, either internal or external, like multi-story atria or open staircases, often illuminated with lots of natural light. How much do you think about how people are going to use those spaces as you're designing them?
Well, architecture is a framework within which people live out their lives. Our role is to make this framework and to give people a sense of dignity and a sense of worth and a sense of elation. I think what was interesting for us in the Venice Biennale manifesto was really teasing out these first principles of architecture, what our material is. We wanted to focus on space because we believe that above all, we are space makers. We're not just object makers. And the basis of civic society is really making places and spaces where people can feel comfortable together. That's one of the key roles of architecture is how to make that Yvonne calls the unexpressed wishes of strangers, that we're dealing with particular users, but we're also dealing with the stranger who passes by or who wanders into a building. That's the joy of city, it's the joy of architecture, it's the joy of collective spaces. You learn by accident, by serendipity. All of those things come into our thinking when we're making space.
Speaking of gathering together and people getting together, how is it to work together as architects to do these projects with both of you involved?
I think it's enriched by having more torches shining light on a particular issue. I think what's wonderful for both Shelley and myself is also the team of people that we have around us, that we really try to have a collective view, that we often discuss architects as translators, that we translate the needs of people into space, you know, whatever they might be, auditoria or classrooms or in-house, depending what it is. So we get this kind of collage of, if we were making a handmade bedspread, all the little pieces, all these handkerchiefs of needs, we try and understand them for what they need to be themselves, and then we try to find a story that weaves this new scenario. We believe every project is like an invention, that every new project has a kind of an element of fiction in it, that you weave a story around which the new lives of all the people, like sometimes projects have, you know, 3,500 people are going to live in these complexes that we might build. The kind of overlap, that's the thing that I suppose that fascinates Shelley and I, is that architecture holds you totally. It holds you in the morning as you wake up. It holds you as you go to school. It holds you in cities or in the countryside. So we really feel passionate about our profession. I think the fault of our profession is that we many times talk to ourselves and not enough to the general public. And the general public are the very people who are affected by all the architectural decisions that are made.
You know, it's interesting. We spoke on this program earlier with Balkrishna Doshi, who also won the Pritzker Prize. He's an Indian architect, and he studied with Le Corbusier. And I asked him what they talked about and what he learned from him. And he said, you know, we never really talked about architecture. We only talked about life and philosophy.
Yeah, well, it's one of the wonderful things about being an architect is that you're not working alone. In fact, it's very difficult to work alone. So those conversations that one has enrich our lives. And it's something that I'm certainly thankful for every day, that I can come into a space here in Dublin and have the best conversations of my life with my colleagues.
What we love really, Jeremy, is when architecture is not the object of delight necessarily, but that people feel the warmth of a brick surface against their back, or that a really beautifully positioned bench holds you when you're tired, or that architecture is at the service of humanity. And we often speak about the fact that since 2008, more than half the world live in cities. So therefore, what is built becomes what we call the new geography, so that what we are building is really the, if you like, the holder, the tender arms that will hold future generations. So that architecture is not only about the beauty of a particular thing, but in how each particular thing is put together and thought about infrastructurally. That's a thing that we're really passionate about, that architects should become much more involved in the infrastructure of cities, how water is dealt with, how sewage is dealt with. All those things could have a cultural component, and are certainly, when vast amount of money are spent on huge human needs, what we would argue for is that a component of that is also thought about at a cultural level.
So what do you think about what's being built right now? Because, you know, for the last many years, a lot of the world has been in a building boom. And what you see going up in many places, certainly in the United States, are big glass towers and kind of boring condo buildings all over the place.
Well, I think good architects need to be given a chance to make the better quality buildings that they are capable of making. And very often, the best architects are sidelined and are not in the forefront for a whole variety of reasons. But just, it's interesting when you talk about glass buildings. What we found extraordinary when we went to Lima, where we won a competition, we made a building in Lima where it really is like a viaduct or an aqueduct or something. It's not like a building at all, in a way, you could say. And that's because we thought about the climate and that you could move externally, because it's a moderate city and It enjoys the breeze from the Pacific. And so the only spaces we made were internal, were the actual teaching spaces in this new University of Engineering in Lima. And so many of the buildings around us were buildings you could find in Sydney or New York or Los Angeles or whatever, all glass buildings. And we just found that so strange. One really has to take the culture and climate of a place and make things which are particular to it, which all of the ancient architects would have done if you look at historic architecture.
Recently, I went to see the film Apollo 11. There were scientists who were able to design a craft that could go from Earth to Moon and come back to the Earth atmosphere. So my point really is that if we can make a craft collectively that can go from our atmosphere to the lunar atmosphere, that we can make buildings of the future that survive. Like, we often refer to a wonderful building in Milan called Ospedale Maggiore, which comes from the 1400s, and it's still in use. It's still a university, it was a hospital, and it has a series of these gorgeous, ordinary courtyards, and it's still a machine. It still works, it's still very beautiful. That architecture is very interesting. It's both the future and the past and the present. So what we would like to discuss, I suppose, and make your audience aware or discuss with you, that can we not think about buildings in the future that have very little maintenance running costs, and that we think about ordinary things that are very beautiful, the height of a floor to ceiling, a lovely window that opens out and you can hear a blackbird sing, that the pleasure of looking at a tree, that architecture can be setting up very, very simple relationships. It doesn't necessarily mean huge expenditure. It actually takes a certain way of thinking.
Well, I could listen to you both all day long, but unfortunately, the biggest room, if you will, that we have in our house of this program is 11 minutes long, and we've gone through it all. But Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara, co-founders of the Irish design firm Grafton Architects and winners of this year's Pritzker Architecture Prize, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
And we've got photos of some of their work at hereandnow.org. By the way, if that interview sounded like a blast from the past with all the talk of convening spaces and getting together, that's because it was. It was recorded in March. The two architects were in the same room. Probably wouldn't happen today. There was an audio engineer recording their end of the conversation. Definitely wouldn't happen today. And I was working from the studio rather than from home. Those were the days.
And you may have recently tried to buy flour or sugar only to be greeted by empty shelves. Darn, everyone else got there first. More people are doing pandemic baking. Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sieg has our story.
Around the same time governors started ordering people to shelter in place, the videos began popping up on YouTube.
Today we're creating the simplest quarantine birthday cake.
Pandemic-themed baking, like that video from a channel called QualiPops, or countless others tapping into the same need. Misty from the Pandemic Keto Comfort Food channel puts it this way.
It's okay to have a treat now and then when you are feeling all the emotions.
She then demonstrates how to make a giant keto cookie. Julie Baker in Grand Junction, Colorado, appreciates these kinds of baking how-tos because as a mom to four young children, she hasn't really had time to bake in years. But now she's got a bunch of restless kids stuck inside, and on the day that we talked, she also had a jug of old, old milk and just the recipe for it.
Man, well, that sour milk is like about to explode in my fridge. So I'm going to do that today because I keep saying, I'm going to do it tomorrow. It has to happen. It's happening today. We are making biscuits.
She hopes that when her children look back on this weird time, they don't remember being afraid. She wants them to remember being together and learning how measuring cups work.
Love and happiness and math.
Diana Rose Yellow, who lives in nearby Fruita, says that when Colorado's governor Jared Polis encouraged people to reach out to others during the pandemic, she knew what to do. Teach folks how to make a Navajo staple over Facebook Live.
So, I'll show you the fry bread that's frying.
Fry bread. golden and glistening.
It's like a newborn baby, and it's so beautiful.
She immediately got thousands of views and lots of comments. Yellow has a public health degree and is a bit chagrined that fry bread has 700 calories per serving.
But since we're in a pandemic, it's all okay, because we'll have to survive on what we've got, you know?
Making and eating too much are just some of the hazards of pandemic baking. In normal times, Katie Langford would bring her treats into the office at the Boulder Daily Camera, and they would quickly disappear. But now she and her roommate are still eating their way through a pie she made with pounds of strawberries and rhubarb.
It's a lot of pie.
That won't keep Langford from the oven, however. Baking is a comfort, a link to a time before coronavirus. Now, like in the past, she can mix flour and water and yeast and make bread.
I can still combine butter and sugar and flour and chocolate chips, and it's going to become cookies. So I think there's just a certain kind of stability in knowing that even though everything feels kind of crazy and uncertain right now, those things are still the same and they still taste delicious.
And since many baked goods freeze well too, she can save them and maybe even share them with her coworkers someday. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg.
So if you've been spending time at home pandemic baking, let us know. Send us some of your pictures. And I'm talking to you, the listeners, but also I'm looking at you, Karen Miller-Metzen and Emiko Tamagawa, our in-house bakers. And you can tag us on Twitter at Here and Now.
Dr. Richard Serrao is an infectious disease doctor who says treating coronavirus can be like treating patients before antibiotics existed, because there's not yet a surefire treatment. Dr. Serrao works at the VA Boston Healthcare System, and he's a clinical associate professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine. He joins us now. Dr. Serrao, you've been working in the COVID wards. What's it been like?
The number one impression is a level of uncertainty that I haven't quite experienced in my medical career. It takes me back to when I was first a medical student and a resident, where you're learning everything anew. And I have to say, from a novel infection, we're learning so many new things. So what I'm present to currently is a somewhat uneasy experience with patients of mine, in whom normally I would walk in, feel quite confident that I could treat such and such. And this scenario, I'm not entirely certain. So I've had some patients who I literally went off service and I said, I think you have made it out of the woods. And I said that at day 15 of their particular illness. And I mentioned day 15 because the second week is usually the week in which patients go from asymptomatic to having symptoms. The most concerning is pneumonia and respiratory decompensation. But I've had some folks who look like they're out of the woods, only to discover that a week later, they're back in the hospital decompensating and on a ventilator.
And some have even died after you told them in person that you thought that they were on the right track.
Absolutely. And that's what makes this, the roadmap, in my opinion, a little bit difficult to offer reassurance, not only to the patient, but to ourselves. And so there's a paradoxical presentation. And I think what I'm alluding to, and a lot of your listeners may be aware, is the intense cytokine storm. It's this intense inflammation that's occurring. Not entirely clear who will manifest that, but again, those with high inflammatory markers, many of my patients in their 70s and 80s are presenting with that. Some have high inflammatory markers. They peak in the amount of oxygen they require, and then they recuperate. Others are doing fine on room air or 2 liters, only to discover that in 12, 24 hours, they're now in a ventilator. And so sometimes it correlates and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, I'm glad you brought up ventilators, because there's been a lot of focus on ventilators, on how many ventilators that hospitals have needed around the country. We know that ventilators can save patients' lives, but a recent study in the Journal of the American Medical Association raised questions about their effectiveness. They found a high death rate for patients who were put on ventilators at 12 hospitals in New York City and Long Island. What do we know at this point about ventilators and whether they do reduce the death rates from COVID-19?
So the best way to frame this answer is ventilators are the last stop on the train, so to speak. And I work on the general medical wards, not the ICU, the intensive care units. And my goal is to prevent as much as I can these patients from finding themselves on ventilators. Long story short, what we aim to do is to avoid that scenario as much as possible. And you may have heard some stories of reported in the literature that other mechanisms, high flow nasal cannula treatment, proning of the patient, positioning the body face down to optimize blood supply to more favorable portions of the lung may offset the need for requiring ventilation.
There's been so much focus on the respiratory effects of this disease, but you've pointed out, as you've looked at all the things that are required to care for people with COVID-19, it affects everything, it seems like, from your head to your toes. There's COVID toes we're now hearing about. Have you ever seen a disease like this that has had so many different effects? And also, do you think there's been too much focus on the respiratory effects, maybe at the expense of trying to treat other areas that could be just as harmful or deadly?
Well, I think you brought up a good point. Keep in mind that the initial presentation of this infection, the most prominent clinical presentation that is obviously life-threatening is COVID pneumonia. So it's a viral pneumonia, but it's also augmented by the immune response, making an individual experience problems breathing as if they're drowning because of that combination. So what we are seeing is more and more case reports of individuals that have recuperated or are asymptomatic presenting with a smattering of unusual symptoms such as anosmia, which is the loss of sense of smell, or dysgeusia, which is the loss or change in the sense of taste. Mm-hmm. Plus these other conditions, you may hear COVID toes. What we do understand about those presentations is thankfully the vast majority of those patients did not progress to COVID pneumonia, whereas individuals who are presenting with fevers and muscle aches and a cough who don't have a loss of sense of smell have a higher probability of progressing towards pneumonia or hospitalization at least.
I just want to pivot now and ask you a couple of questions that we're all thinking about at the moment. As you watch states open up, you know, at different speeds right now, what do you think about that? Is it okay for some states to say the worst is over, it's time to get people back to work?
Well, a couple lessons that we're learning from this is the response to a pandemic and the focus on the public health and infection and death rates versus the economy. To me, that balance is extremely challenging, and it makes me nervous. But I need to sort of qualify that. We do understand that in certain communities, there may be much more asymptomatic transmission or carriage of this virus than originally anticipated. So it really comes down to the prevalence of, in other words, the disease burden at a particular point in time in populations to establish, is that a safe thing to do? So I believe when Dr. Fauci and the CDC are mentioning this has to be done a very, very evidence-based with an understanding of what type of communities have what level of prior infection.
When Dr. Fauci talked about the antiviral drug remdesivir, which has had some early stage success in tests, he said that it wasn't a knockout, that we have figured out a way to stop the virus. That's what he said, but that it wasn't a knockout. Are you optimistic there will be a knockout treatment or even a vaccine by the fall?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. I think remdesivir could very well be the front runner. And when Dr. Fauci says now we have a comparator arm, meaning we now have a drug that has demonstrated some improvement, and now we can continue to study it at different doses, different time intervals, higher doses for longer, for shorter. So time will tell. And on another note, one of the observations I had is that this became an exercise in restraint for me. As a provider on the general medicine wards, I have a patient who I do not want to die. And so it's very difficult to say no to something like hydroxychloroquine based on very preliminary data that it could be useful. But now we discover that, for example, that drug isn't as useful and maybe more harmful than we know. And so every week that goes by, I always say, every week that goes by, we understand this a little bit more. We have more clarity. We have more signal-to-noise clarity in this pandemic. This time period is one in which I feel like I can offer the least amount. Once the drugs have demonstrated more efficacy, then we'll know that, hey, we can finally treat this, decrease the downstream damage that occurs from this. And in combination with other therapeutics like these interleukin 6 inhibitors, you may be hearing a lot about tocilizumab and sarilumab. These drugs are what we're using now in combination, but with further studies to come out in the near future.
How are you doing personally?
Well, it reminds me of my first decade being a healthcare provider, in which I relied quite heavily on the science and the clinical and the evidence. This time around, this uncertainty is personally unnerving because I cannot quite yet rely on the clinical. I think in 3-6 months from now, this may end up being a happier scenario. Even though it may return in the fall with a fervor, we may have more things to treat this with. And as a result of that, I think feeling a little less unable to do things, that will melt away. And I will think as a physician, I will be able to offer much more than I have now.
That is Dr. Richard Serrao, who is a clinical associate professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine and also an infectious disease specialist at the VA. Dr. Serrao, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.
And we should mention Dr. Serrao has advised our workplace, WBUR, about public health during the pandemic.
So has being cooped up with your loved ones been difficult? Well, at least you're not Ernest Hemingway, or we should say his wife Hadley. In the summer of 1926, she found herself in quarantine with her son Bumby, who had whooping cough, Bumby's nanny, her husband, Bumby's father, Ernest Hemingway's mistress, Pauline Pfeiffer, soon joined by the man himself, all of them together in a small cottage. Bumby would eventually recover from his illness. The Hemingway marriage did not. Author Leslie Bloom tells this story in Town and Country magazine. Leslie, welcome.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Well, and we also want to thank you because apparently you're huddled in your closet trying to get a quiet place to talk to us.
Yes, highly professional, glamorous environment to be broadcasting right now.
So Town and Country of you. You start your article by trying to correct the record on a story that went viral that wasn't true. It alleged that F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote a letter when he was in quarantine in 1920 for the then 1918 flu. And this letter claimed that Hemingway was a flu denier who wouldn't wash his hands. You wanted to point out that letter wasn't true.
No, well, first of all, it was written in 1920, supposedly. Fitzgerald did not meet Hemingway until 1925.
Aha.
And yes, so that was, you know, a rather significant clue that something was peculiar about said letter. It turns out that, you know, the letter wasn't real and it was a parody that was written for McSweeney's.
But this story you're about to help us tell is, and talk about people behaving badly. It begins in Paris. Hemingway, his wife Hadley, who's kind of a plain, as you say, church mouse, poor woman, their son Jack, or Bumby as they called him. They had moved there so that Hemingway could be a famous writer. As part of that, of course, he has to have an affair. He does with the Vogue editor, Pauline Pfeiffer.
Hadley just, she really didn't quite know how to deal with it at first. Should she laugh it off and hope that it blew over, or should she probably start to come to terms with the fact that Hemingway was going to choose Pauline over her? And I think that, you know, she was just getting used to the fact that Pauline was a real threat to the marriage when this strange interlude happened.
Well, the strange interlude is that Hemingway goes off to watch a bullfight. Hadley takes their son to visit friends, but the son is diagnosed with whooping cough, so they have to leave. The Fitzgeralds, who by now are their friends, have a cottage they can use as this quarantine shelter. Hadley moves in with the little boy and the nanny, but then soon along comes Pauline Pfeiffer.
Yeah, just what everybody wants, right? To be in quarantine with your husband's mistress. I mean, I don't know about you. I don't think I could take that right now.
No, and then he comes too. How did they do this?
Well, it's, look, historical record's a little unclear about how Pauline materialized down in the Riviera. Some say, look, you know, she went down to help Hadley. She had had whooping cough as a child. She was immune. And we all know, you know, how precious immunity is now, right, from our own experiences. You know, other historical sources say that Hemingway asked her to go down to help relieve Hadley because Hadley was going bananas. So she comes down, and then Hemingway comes also. And Hemingway, the mistress, the nanny, the sick little boy, and Hadley are all in a two-bedroom cottage quarantined for weeks.
Hemingway thought this was just grand, like a great place to write. Do we know what it did to Hadley?
Hadley was really at the end of her tether, and, you know, she would take, you know, isolated walks into town. Once in a while, she would, you know, get a shot of whiskey someplace to steel herself to go back. Now, it's worth noting that, you know, when the Fitzgeralds and their other friends from the Riviera come to visit them, they're the, you know, pioneer social distancers. They're standing behind a fence on the driveway or on the front road while the Hemingway menage a trois is on the front porch. And, you know, on one hand, the Fitzgeralds, who are full of mischief always, they're there to keep the Hemingways and Pauline company, but they're also there to see what's going on. I mean, it's quite an unorthodox arrangement.
It's an odd story. You know, it reads kind of with a fantastic devil-may-care kind of attitude, but it's real human beings. I mean, what a terrible quarantine story.
It's a terrible quarantine story, but with strange fashionablenesses to it also. And the thing that makes it especially strange is that the people in the story are not behaving how most of us would behave. I think that's what makes it so fascinating and strange. And so Hemingway possibly sending his mistress and then going himself and enjoying the setup or finding it, you know, a nice spot for writing. Pauline actually making herself available to go down and help, you know, Hemingway's wife with the baby. And then Hadley's own acceptance of the arrangement or trying to put a good face on it also seems unfathomable. But maybe the most relatable reaction of the three, somebody who's just trying to grapple with the situation and feel her way to the right path through it.
And by the way, did Pfeiffer get her man ultimately? She would say throughout, I'm going to get everything. Did she?
Yeah. Well, I mean, she got him temporarily. She was wife number two. And then he jilted her from Martha Gellhorn. And then Martha got rid of him, and then he went on to another journalist, his final wife, Mary, who became Mary Hemingway.
Leslie Bloom wrote about Hemingway's quarantine for Town and Country. She adapted the piece from her book, Everybody Behaves Badly, the true story behind Hemingway's masterpiece, The Sun Also Rises. Leslie, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're released from the closet.
Oh. And the door's been flung open. Please be safe, and thank you very
thank
much
you.
For having me on.
And Leslie's new book, Fallout, is out in August. And Jeremy, this week we're going to have famed marriage counselor Esther Perel. A husband in one of her podcasts wants this problem. I cannot imagine. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.